England, There, England by A.G. McDonnell. Adapted in six parts by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips. Episode 6.
The SS Wilno bucketed laboriously into Hull on the morning of New Year's Eve, 1927. Its only passenger, the shy young Scotsman, Donald Cameron, disembarked and headed for London, arriving that evening. He found a few letters waiting for him, among them one from Sir Henry Wotton's sister, a Mrs. Fielding, inviting him to spend a few days in Buckinghamshire.
It won't be a party, just ourselves. I hope you won't find it too dull.
2 days later, he was at Marylebone, that most dignified of stations, where the porters go on tiptoe, the barrows have rubber tires, and the trains sidle in and out, oh so softly, so as not to disturb the signalman. There he bought a ticket to Aylesbury. As the train pulled in, Mr. Fielding was waiting on the platform.
Sorry about the car.
Not at all. I love old things.
No, it's all right. I can never get near our new car, so I have to hang on to the one my daughters say they wouldn't be seen dead in.
A 3-mile clatter in the veteran roadster brought them to the Golden Hind, which was the name of the Fielding's house. It was a long, low building, pale red brick and unstained timber beams.
Mind your head in the house. It's a perfect death trap.
Thanks, I will.
Donald stooped as he went in, but on meeting Mrs. Fielding, his natural chivalry caused him to stand upright.
Mind your head on the beam.
Oh, it was a shattering blow, but at least it broke the ice, as well as the skin. And by the time Mrs. Fielding had finished fussing around with iodine, bandages and lint, and the jumble of terriers had licked his face and fought a brisk skirmish across his chest, Donald felt he'd been an intimate friend of the family for years.
There. I think you'll live.
Thank you.
Just try to avoid standing.
Oh, no, it's all right. I don't feel dizzy.
The beams, dear, remember?
Oh, yes, of course.
Is dinner ready yet? I've got to chair the Scouts Committee at 8, you know.
I know, but don't be all night about it, or we'll miss the tennis club AGM.
Or if I'm in the way...
Oh, no, not at all, not at all. You just come and go as you please.
You might like to sample the ale in the Crooked Billet. Plenty of material for you there.
Thanks.
After dinner, Donald strolled across in the starlight to the Crooked Billet. On entering the barroom, he aroused only the slightest of attention, after which he was almost forgotten, and was able to look round at his ease. There were 10 men in the room, all of them old.
When Lord Salisbury was in office, I voted for Lord Salisbury. And when Mr. Gladstone was in office, I voted for Mr. Gladstone. Because there never was a perfect difference between them, I could say.
No, Lord Salisbury, there was a man for you. I heard him speak once.
What did he say?
Couldn't understand a word. A fine gentleman he was.
Ah, there are too many of them about nowadays.
Oh, say that again. Too many.
I saw Mr. Dickens once. A fine-looking gentleman with a big beard. Same as Mr. Stillaway's over there. Only bigger. Yeah, he was a gentleman who liked a good laugh, he was.
People don't seem to laugh now like they used to. I don't know why it is.
As no one else seemed to know why it was either, there was a gap in the conversation. Donald plucked up sufficient courage to fill it.
Excuse me. Does anybody know when the hunt is likely to be meeting?
They meet at Tainted Green tomorrow, sir. That's a matter of 2 miles from here.
Thank you.
They'll find one up near Stacey's tomorrow. I saw him today, the old rascal. I remember finding one at Stacey's when I was second horseman to Mr. Selby. 2 hours and 40 minutes she gave us, and I never saw a faster run. We killed her at Grendon Church.
What year would that be?
I can't rightly remember, sir, but it was a year that Mr. Selby sent us all off to London to see the great exhibition.
If you don't mind my asking, how old is he?
He's 98 come Martinmas, sir.
Really? I couldn't help noticing that the, younger men of the village don't seem to drink here. No. Is there another inn?
No, sir, they don't drink here, nor nowhere else, neither. The young chaps, they hardly drinks at all.
Why is that?
Oh, well, for one thing, ain't the money about it there was.
Beer costs twice as much.
And there's picture houses and charabans and motor bicycles with girls sitting on behind.
Boy Scouts are very strong in this village.
So I believe.
Yeah, lots of the young chaps are scout masters, so they don't drink as an example to the lads.
Quite right, too.
Then you see, there's no one between them. Old chaps like us.
Oh, you mean all the rest were.
Most of them, sir. 42. Killed from this village.
That's right, 42.
I've been men of 35 or 40 by now.
That war did none of us any good. Nothing has been the same since.
And what did we gain by it?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Well, there are those who'd say it was a matter of national honour.
But can you tell me, sir, what national honour does for me? I've worked on the land all my life, and in 1914, a man comes down to the green here, and he makes a speech about that very national honour you just mentioned. And at that time, the nation and all its honour were giving me 22 shillings a week, and I was working 72 hours a week for it. 72 hours a week I was working for it. But I had to give 3 sons and 8 grandsons to fight for the national honour. 11 of them. And 3 were killed and 2 lost their legs. Yeah, what good did that do them or me? Or anyone sitting here?
Cost 11's higher. Beer's more expensive.
And tobacco?
And my grandsons, the ones that weren't killed, they can't get no work. And all that for what you call national honour.
Under a clear, cold sky, Donald walked slowly and thoughtfully back to the Golden Hind, where Mr. and Mrs. Fielding were poring over a small, dog-eared notebook.
Help yourself to whiskey, Cameron. We'll be finished in a moment.
Thank you.
Now, if Mrs. Burchett can't pay her rent, I don't see that we have any choice.
She can't possibly pay, John. She's had rheumatism so badly all winter, she's had to give up taking in washing. And that means dropping 15 shillings a week at least. And both her boys are out of work.
Well, then it simply can't be helped. We'll just have to go without.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about Henry Davis?
He's been out of work for 12 weeks now. And his wife's just had twins.
So we can't worry him for rent just now.
No.
But that leaves old Mrs. Mitchell. And she says, will we take 2 shillings a week next month instead of 4 and 6? What's the trouble there, Florence?
Young Mitchell's been in trouble again.
Oh, damn that boy. Whereabouts this time?
Bristol. A maid servant, as usual. She's got an order against him and he didn't pay, so now he's in prison.
Oh, I'd like to get that young blaggard up before the headquarters sessions. We'll bring Mrs. Mitchell down to 2 shillings. Now, Florence, is that all? We've been neglecting Mr. Cameron scandalously.
No, I have been enjoying myself enormously. I was a farmer once myself. But it was a different sort of farming to all this.
You don't look like a farmer, Mr. Cameron.
I've tried very hard to get rid of the traces.
Why, didn't you like farming? We adore living on the land.
But what a different land. Where I farmed, the soil was poor and the stones were plentiful. Mm. Here, you've got colour, you've got fruit blossom, and you've been here such a long time. You're settled and cosy. I've been over just now in the Crooked Billet, listening to your old men talking. One of them had seen Dickens. Mm. We haven't anything like that in Scotland.
Oh, you've got other things to be proud of.
Of course we have, lots of them. But somehow, all this down here makes Scotland seem rather disjointed.
You were such bloodthirsty ruffians, that was your trouble. Always scrapping. We've been too busy making money for all that. Nation of shopkeepers, eh?
No, you are the most unpractical race in the world.
Oh, come, Mr. Cameron. You can't possibly defend that state.
Yes, Cameron, that's going a bit too far. If there's one thing we are good at, it's money-making and business. Well, I sometimes think we overdo it a bit and drive bargains that are too hard.
I couldn't help overhearing that you were preparing to drive some pretty hard bargains with your tenants just now.
Well, that's a different story altogether. Let's see, one or two of them have had a bit of hard luck lately, and, well, one can't Shylock the poor devils. But when it comes to a business deal, I flatter myself I'm as good a man as my neighbours.
Perhaps that's because they're all English.
Mr. Cameron, you left your Tess of the D'Urbervilles on the hall table.
No, that's not mine.
No? That's funny. I hadn't seen it before. Perhaps it belongs to one of the girls, eh, John?
Matter of fact, I picked it up today. It's a first edition, dear. Quite valuable.
I can see it's a first edition, dear. Where did you find it? In Aylesbury?
Not exactly. More sort of here.
Oh, John, the vicar's been at you again. How much did you give him?
Well, my dear, he does have 7 children. And what good's a first edition to him?
How much did you give him?
It is in perfect preservation.
£300?
As a matter of fact...
John, if you want to keep that sort of thing from me, you shouldn't use my checkbook.
Well, there we are, Cameron. I'm afraid I drove a pretty hard bargain with the vicar. But after all, business is business.
Yes, and considering the market value of a Tess first edition is probably no more than £50.
Oh, nonsense. It's a first-class investment. I won't have it said the English are bad businessmen. Say when, Cameron. Say when.
Next day, the dawn ushered in a warm January morning, sunny and spring-like, and Donald felt there should have been buttercups in the meadows, with larks above them and swallows fooling about, and great drifts of the flower the English call bluebells, but the Scots know as wild hyacinths. As he walked across Tainton Green, there came a point where no buildings were visible. There was no sign of human life. At last, he was in the heart of rural England. He'd just begun to daydream about Fibar Gates and plodding ploughmen when...
Hey, you! You finished sleeping in the middle of the road. Where the devil's Tainton Green?
I imagine it's straight on, but I'm afraid...
God, another bloody stranger.
Tainton Green looked as if a celestial town planner had scattered Tudor cottages out of a pepper pot, and then, as an afterthought, had flung down a handful of rather large Queen Anne houses. But Donald did no more than glance at the architecture. His attention was concentrated on the most famous of all English sporting spectacles, the meet of a pack of foxhounds. Punctually at 11 o'clock, the whole fox-killing apparatus moved off sedately towards a wood outside the village. Donald strained his eyes till the last scarlet pinhead had vanished behind the horizon of dark woods, leaving an empty landscape of dull greys, browns and greens. The splendour had gone.
Good luck to you. And a fat chance you've got against 60 dogs and 107 riders and 107 horses. 274-1.
He moved down the road to get out of the way of the pursuing angels, so nobly bent on saving the countryside from vermin. There was a halt at the edge of the coppice, for the fox had gone to ground. He had outrun all 274 of them. But they had the last laugh thanks to the consignment of spades and a couple of terriers. After all, to deprive 60 dogs of the midday meal they'd so bravely earned would be an act of callous cruelty to dumb animals, and no Englishman could ever be guilty of that. Donald began his homeward journey and in 10 minutes came upon an animated scene. Just where his winding lane joined the main road, a caravan of gypsies had halted their motley crew of painted wagons. Furious voices were being raised, spouting language that would have startled Nell Gwyn. Before long, the flow of words had given way to a fast bout of fisticuffs between a 6-foot, scarlet-coated, scarlet-faced young man and a lean, dark gypsy. The bout lasted only a few seconds, for the fighters were dragged apart by other gentlemen in red coats, and the gypsy retired sullenly.
That bloody swine was kicking his horse.
Bloody swine!
Bravo, Ralph! Well done, my boy!
Thank God it was a gypsy and not an Englishman!
An Englishman wouldn't do a thing like that!
If there's one thing that gets me mad, it's cruelty to animals. I don't care if it's a mouse or an elephant, it simply makes me see red.
We never go abroad nowadays, except to La Touquet and Monte Carlo. We simply can't stand the way those chaps treat animals.
Someone should report him.
Report him? Why doesn't someone flog him?
Donald heard no more, for at that moment the shoulder of a horse took him neatly in the small of the back and knocked him into the hedge. The woman riding never even glanced in his direction. She just carried on, asking the party at large why no one had flogged the gypsy. But before taking his unexpected tumble, Donald had recognised her as one of the nurses in a wartime hospital near Flanders. One pouring wet night, this hard-faced Diana had carried out 7 wounded officers from a burning ward into which the stretcher-bearers had refused to go. On another occasion, she'd held the hand of a dying subaltern for 27 hours. On Monday morning, another meandering train crept stealthily towards Marylebone, with Donald among its passengers. On the journey, he read in the Times that the second fox had completely let down the North Buck's hunt. The wretched creature had nipped off at a great rate and dived down a hole, from which not even the valiant terriers could extract him. He was, as the Times said, a bad fox. During the early spring of 1928, Donald was very busy. He'd collected enough notes about England and the English to fill 14 large exercise books, and he decided it was high time to start putting them together in some sort of shape before making any more expeditions to gather new material. But the evenings were kept completely free from work, so he was still at liberty to attend functions, like the one at the Hotel Josephine, thrown by the exquisite film actress Esmeralda Davenport. Esmeralda, in her usual lavish style, had engaged the half-dozen ballrooms for her party. Donald arrived at about 11:30 and found his hostess in the supper room, superbly beautiful as ever.
I must have the next dance but 2 and the 2 after that, Donald. I need to talk to you. Sorry, darlings, I adore you all, but business is business.
Well, that will be a delight.
Won't it?
The fatal kindliness of Donald's friend, Mad Tommy Huggins, once more overtaken him, for it was Huggins who had spread the absurd notion that the boy was a Hollywood mogul. Donald felt despairingly that when Esmeralda finally discovered the truth, she might express her annoyance with extreme measures. And he was very anxious to avoid a quick hook to the jawline from her alabaster, yet undeniably muscular, right arm.
With this thought in mind, he fled in anguish to the roof garden and looked out over Park Lane. An interval of at least 45 minutes elapsed before he realised with a gasp that the next dance but two, and probably the next two after that, were long since finished. Roof garden had begun to fill up with people he knew, and the smell of sausages and bacon began to drift towards him. He'd just begun a futile attempt to lose himself in the crowd when...
Donald!
Oh, there you are. Look, I'm really...
Do you know what you've just done?
I can explain.
You've just won me £200.
How?
I bet Snarks Muggleston and Tony Spratt that you'd cut my three dances. And they were so sure of my S.A., they jumped at it. So I've won all round. A compliment and £200 from them and... another slap in the face from you.
Oh, I didn't mean to.
I think you're fascinating.
Esmeralda, what ho!
No.
Cameron, what ho! Huggins, what ho!
Excuse me, Esmeralda. Huggins, come with
what?
Me.
Cameron, I didn't know you knew Esmeralda. The finest of ladies had ever played the soubrette in the musical version of Hamlet.
Lunatic, of course I know Mr. Cameron. But he's cruel and hard-hearted and won't give me a job.
Oh, the low fiend of hell. Then I shall give you a job in my factory at Waterlooville, making left-foot gumboots for men who've lost their right legs.
Thank you, Tommy, but I'd sooner have a job in Mr. Cameron's film.
Film? Don't fall for that old dodge. The bogus film magnate's the oldest trick in the book. Cameron, I'm ashamed of you, trying to seduce an innocent maiden with your caveman approach.
No, just a minute. It was
I know the type. Catch you by the ankle and the seat of the pants and chuck you into a passing tram car.
That's all you know, Tommy.
But I tell you, he's not a film man, are you, Cameron?
Well, you are, aren't you, Donald?
Ah, Miss Davenant. Splendid gallery.
Oh, thank you, Major General.
Dashed warm for April. Oh, it reminds me of Abbottabad.
Actually, yes. It is remarkably warm.
Yes, look. Cameron's perspiring.
All right, this has gone on far too long. If you must know the truth,
Ladies and gentlemen, I am the senior officer present. You will kindly regard me as Officer Commanding Josephine Roofgarden. Captain de Wilton Fallow, reconnoiter the main staircase and report to me.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Cameron, Mr. Carshorten Stanbury, and Mr. Worldingham Huffingham, reconnoiter the fire escape and all other routes of retreat and report to me.
Yes, yes sir.
Remainder, sit.
Though the heat grew intense, as yet there was no sound of crackling flame, so Giuliano, the waiter from Catford, went round refilling the tumblers with a new supply of Lernbrow.
Has anyone got a camera? If not, we'll just have to go straight into the nearest studio the moment we get out.
How about a rescue scene? Esmeralda in my arms.
Don't be absurd.
Oh, come. She's not as heavy as all that.
It's not the top floor, sir. It's the one below. Absolutely blazing.
What about the staircase?
Impossible, sir. Mass of flame.
Cameron, is there a fire escape?
Well, yes and no.
Talk sense, man.
Yes, there is a fire escape, but it stops four stories below us. There's no other way off the roof.
Then there's nothing to be done but wait for the fire engines. Any sign of them? You, what's your name?
My name is Giuliano, sir.
I didn't ask you your name. I asked you if there was any sign of a fire engine.
You did ask him his name.
My surname's Ellis.
And a fire engine's arrived.
It was not a moment too soon. Smoke was already pouring up the staircase.
The garrison will form column of route, preparatory to descending by the ladder. Ladies leading.
The ladder's coming up.
Good, because the floor's going down.
Hello, mister. Didn't we meet on the SS Wilmore?
Mr. Rhodes, what are you doing here?
It's my ladder machine. I've just made it, and I'm teaching these firemen chaps how to use it. Had to come up and see how it went.
The race was now desperate. The women were all clear, but the floor of the roof garden was cracking and sagging. The gentleman went over quietly and efficiently to the accompaniment of Mr. Huggins singing the Marseillaise in a marked Lancashire accent. The last two down were William Rhodes, ecstatic over the success of his machine, and the Major General. The immense crowd in Park Lane was delirious with joy.
Donald looked up with a mixture of relief at having survived and despair at how the evening's events had affected his plans for the book. After all those months of preparation, he now felt more baffled than ever by the Englishman. What was he to make of the fearsome Major General being answered back by an Italian waiter called Ellis? Or the sight that faced him now of the international star Esmeralda Devenor being photographed embracing Rhodes, an engineer from Yorkshire? Or Huggins, by now unstoppable medley of French marching tunes delivered in broad Lancastrian? Concluding that he set himself a lifelong task that the book would never be finished until he was, Donald inadvertently became the elusive, typical Englishman he sought by walking away from the scene of the disaster in search of a cup of tea.
Part 6 of England There, England by A.G. MacDonald was adapted by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips, with Sam Graham as Donald Cameron, Peter Kelly as Mr. Fielding, Denise Coffey as Mrs. Fielding, Katie Odie as Esmeralda, Christopher Benjamin as Captain de Wilton Fallow, and Robin Bailey as the Major General. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Graham Harper, Kevin Oliver, and Chaz Hamilton. The director was Neil Cargill. England There, England is a Splice of Life production for BBC Radio 2.